3 years ago, 16 members of an Amish community living in Burkholz, Ohio, attacked 9 Amish men and women who had been forced to leave their community by cutting off their beards and hair. They wanted to get revenge because the victims had been critical of their bishop, a man named Samuel Mullet. It was a national news story because the Amish are known for their peaceful and forgiving ways. The defendants were charged under the Hate Crimes Prevention Act that makes it illegal to attack someone based on their gender, sexual orientation, disability, race, ethnicity, or in this case, religion. They were also charged with conspiracy, lying, and concealing evidence. While all were found guilty, Bishop Mullet received the harshest sentence. In August, an appellate court overturned the hate crime verdicts. Our guest, Donald Craybill, testified at the trial for the prosecution and is the author of a new book called Renegade Amish, Beard-Cutting Hate Crimes and the Trial of the Burkholz Barbers. He's a distinguished college professor and senior fellow at the Young Center for Anabaptist and Pietist Studies at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania. He's the author of a number of books about the Amish, and including one for a PBS series. And Donald Craybill, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure to be here.
You know, this is such a crazy, shocking story, and it almost feels like one of those horrible Discovery channel shows about the Amish.
It's really a bizarre story, and when I first heard about it, I didn't think it was true at first. I thought it was some prank or someone got something wrong, and I began investigating and discovered that, in fact, it was a true story. But it's unprecedented in Amish history to have forcible attacks like this focused on a beard. Almost everything about the story, including the development of the community, is just unprecedented in 325 years of Amish history.
Well, let's talk about the creation of this community. This goes back to 1995. This man, Samuel Mullet, began this Amish community in an eastern section of Ohio, and it seemed he didn't just reject modernity, because most Amish do that, but even the more sort of normal or regular forms of being Amish, he rejected that as well.
He was trying to set up a more strict Amish community. He purchased about 800 acres of old coal land where there were open mines with water in a mountainous area. He wanted to be excluded in a secluded area. The village of Burkholz is about 600 people, and he was about 3 miles west of that. And at first, a number of his adult children, he and his wife had 18 children, 16 of which are living. Some of his children, adult children, came and joined the community. Eventually, some other non-Mullet people came and joined. And in 1998, he was ordained minister, and in 2001, he was ordained bishop. And gradually, the community grew, and then there was a crisis in 2006, where he excommunicated over the course of maybe 6 or 7 months, 9 different families. And that really was a major turning point, because many of the people that were excommunicated were not members of Mullet's family. So from that time on, it evolves into a clan. And by 2010, all of the families there are in some way related to Mullet, either his son-in-laws, daughter-in-laws, nephews or nieces, with the exception of one person, one household. So it really became a clan with some, in my judgment, cult-like practices.
And I do want to get to all of that, but what's interesting, as you write, and this is a community you know well, most of us only know them from the buggies that we see being driven around in places like Lancaster, but there aren't the kind of rules. It seems in many ways sort of a DIY, do-it-yourself. If someone wants to become a bishop or start a community, they seem to have a lot of authority to be able to set that up.
Well, yes and no. Yes, in starting a community, any Amish person can go out and set up a community and hope that other Amish families will join them. But to become an ordained official, there is a process of selecting them, which is from the outside looks like a random lottery. They view it as a very highly infused religious practice, where the congregation nominates people men who would be eligible for ministry, and there may be six or seven of those in a pool, and then they're randomly selected. They randomly select one. So there have been some suggestions that things were a little fishy, shall we say, here, because he came in.
Sam Mullett.
Right. Bought all this land. Then he becomes the first ordained minister, and then the bishop, and so on. And it's a little difficult historically to unravel some of the factors of what actually happened or different perspectives. So you can't just announce that you're a bishop, but you can buy land. You can set up a community. And the other factor here that you touch on is that there is a lot of independence to each local Amish church district. And the Amish name is not protected. I mean, there's no registration, no trademark. It's not protected legally. So anyone can go out, any quirky person that wants to say that they're going to be Amish can put out the Amish shingle and basically declare that they're Amish, and there's not really anything anybody can do about it. And that was an issue through the trial because the Burkholz defendants kept saying they are Amish. The government says, well, they purport to be Amish. I develop about 25 reasons in the book to basically argue these folks are not Amish in any way in the orthodox conventional sense of what it means to be Amish over 300 years of Amish history. They may call themselves Amish, and they do, in fact, dress Amish. They do drive horse and buggy. They do speak Pennsylvania Dutch. But beyond that, in terms of their beliefs and behaviors, they are far from the Amish fold.
Well, as you say, from your perspective, you saw this community, this Amish community, become a clan with cultish aspects to it. What you write about, and apparently what happened in this community in Burkholz, Ohio, is that Bishop Mullett becomes controls just about everything that happens in his community.
He's very autocratic. He's the bishop. He's the founder of the settlement. He's the oldest man in the settlement. He's grandfather, Doughty, which is an endearing figure. So he has an enormous amount of power coalescing on his lap, so to speak.
Well, and he does things like paddling. I mean, there was a time when people would have public paddlings for bad thoughts or certain kinds of misbehaviors. People were put into pens, like dog pens or cattle pens, again, as a form of punishment.
Well, all these are bizarre. And unheard of in Amish life. The Amish don't use any physical discipline of adults. And so the paddling ritual, it was just bizarre. Also placing them in so-called Amish jails, which, as you said,
is that what they called them? Yeah.
They nicknamed them Amish jails. It could be a small chicken house, a dog pen, a goat pen, whatever. And they would stay there for several days and sometimes 2 or 3 weeks. They were fed, and Mullett always said, well, the door's not locked. They're not real jails. But as one of the ex-members told me, who witnessed all this, he said, well, everybody was afraid to leave because of Sam. So there was fear. There was a threat of physical violence, physical punishment if you left the community. Several families left at night because they were afraid. So it was a very autocratic, high control, very intimidating, threatening environment, which is completely, completely different from your typical Amish community.
Well, indeed, and does have this very cultish feel to it, including the fact that it appeared that Bishop Mullett was taking sexual advantage of some of the women who were living in this community
There was a lot of evidence of sexual promiscuity related to him. In fact, when the FBI arrived a day before Thanksgiving in the fall of 2011, 6 o'clock in the morning, they came to his bedroom, and he came out with the wife of one of his nephews who spent the night there. So those it's a sad story of an old man in power that sort of does things his way and also takes advantage of women.
I mean, it seems like a cult to me. I'm not an expert, but the things that I know
about
it. Well,
it's not a real cult in a sense. They weren't recruiting outside people. Typically, a cult will recruit outside people, have a series of ritual brainwashing, initiation rites, and so on. So in the book, I sort of say, yes, it has some cult-like characteristics, but on the other hand, it's not a full-blown cult like Jonestown or Heaven's Gate or some of these that we've seen in the last 15 or 20 years where they really have a large following. They actively are out recruiting people and have a rigid program of mind control when they come in. This is more of a clan, but it has some of those cult-like features.
Your book begins with these vivid descriptions of these attacks where some 16 members of this community attack a number of Amish men and women, go into their homes, shave off their beards, shave sometimes the women's hair as well. But this was not sort of a casual cutting off of the hair. This was a brutal
attack, malicious,
as you describe
it. It's malicious. And they restrained them. They kidnapped them. I mean, technically what they did fit the qualifications for kidnapping, where you hold and restrain, you assault someone. These people were in bed. It was at night. It was at 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. The Amish typically go to bed quite early because they don't have electricity. We'll go to bed by 8:30 or 9 o'clock. Dragging old men, 76-year-old bishop, out of his bed. So they were very malicious and very disgraceful. I mean, the beard is a very prominent symbol of Amish identity and religious devotion for men. And so to cut off the beard, it was a smart, clever way to disgrace someone for weeks. I mean, the one bishop I interviewed who was a victim, he said he didn't go out of the house for 6 or 8 weeks. He finally, when he went to church 2 or 3 months later to preach for the first time, when his grandchildren saw him, even then they cried because it's just degrading and disgraceful and shaming. And so the Bergholtz barbers were very clever because they knew what they could do that would be the most disgraceful kind of assault on a person apart from physically cutting their body.
Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Donald Krehbiel is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's been a guest in the past when we have done programs about the Amish, and we are talking about a group of Amish. You probably read about it a couple of years ago, a group of Amish living in a community in Bergholtz, Ohio, 16 members of that community attacking Amish men and women, cutting off their beards, cutting off their hair. And Donald Krehbiel's book is called Renegade Amish, and it's subtitled Beard Cutting, Hate Crimes, and the Trial of the Bergholtz Barbers. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Lincoln Motor Company, introducing the first ever Lincoln MKC with available active noise control that reduces unwanted cabin noise to help provide a more pleasant driving experience. More at Lincoln.com.
With his Live at the Apollo album, James Brown pleaded, shimmied, and screamed his way to mainstream stardom. No longer just the king of the Chitlin' circuit, he became America's godfather of soul.
More than 50 years after it was recorded, we look back at Live at the Apollo with James Brown biographer R.J. Smith.
Take my hand, yeah.
That's this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Security cameras captured the carnage as terrorists killed more than 60 people in a Kenyan mall last year. In a new film, we see the video and hear from survivors who escaped.
I was looking at his face. He was young. And he looked at me and he fired.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Bad energy habits around the office can affect your bottom line. PICO, smart ideas for your business can help with customized tips, information, and programs designed to save you energy and money. Learn more at PICO.com/smart ideas. PICO supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. If you're just joining us, Donald Krehbiel is our guest. He's a distinguished college professor, also senior fellow at the Young Center for Anabaptist and Pietist Studies at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania. His new book is called Renegade Amish, Beard-Cutting Hate Crimes and the Trial of the Burkholz Brothers. He's the author, co-author, editor of more than a dozen books on Amish culture, and we are talking about this particular case that got so much attention a couple of years ago. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I was thinking as I was reading your book and even some of the pictures that are included in the book of some of these men and their beard and the thought of having that beard cut off, thinking also back to World War II, pictures of women who had, for instance, collaborated with the Nazis and having their heads shaved, again, as this form of sort of shame and repudiation and shunning, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's particularly for a religious community to have the hair cut when it has religious meaning, both for the women and the men, and especially the beard for the men, is a very disgraceful kind of thing. It became a very interesting issue at the trial, which took place in September 2012 for 3 weeks, because to be charged and convicted of a federal hate crime, the statute says you need to cause bodily injury. You need to cause bodily injury to someone because of six potential things, their religion, their race, their sexual orientation, their gender identity, a disability that they have, or their country of origin. So is cutting off a beard a form of bodily injury? Well, the statute gives five or six examples in law that it could mean, dysfunctional organ where you're attacked and your liver is cut. You lose your arm, a limb, and so on. Or you have a cut in the face. And the one is disfigurement, however temporary. So is a beard disfigurement? And the jury had this debate, well, is a beard part of your body or isn't it? Skin is part of your body, but is a beard? Well, in the end, they all agreed unanimously that cutting a beard is temporary disfigurement. But it's sort of the outer boundary of what bodily injury is. So anything more than cutting a beard is certainly bodily injury in terms of how that jury defined it.
Well, and what's interesting, and we don't know the result of this, an appeals court overturned that, I guess, portion of the verdict, the hate crimes part of
the
verdict.
Well, the defendants appealed to the 6th U.S. District Appellate Court, Federal Court in Cincinnati, which is responsible for several states. And when an appeal comes like that, the court assigns three judges to review it and make a decision. And two of the judges said that they felt an error was made in the instructions to the jury because the jury was instructed to determine, was religion a significant motivating factor? Was it a significant motivating factor? And two of them said, well, what the instruction should have said is, was religion the dominant factor?
Wow.
Because you could have three significant factors. And then the dissenting judge took issue with that. But then the other issue was, well, if it was an error, was it a harmless error or was it harmful? And the two judges that had the majority opinion said it was an error and it was also harmful because it changed the verdicts. The dissenting judge said, no, it wasn't harmful because it was clear that this whole thing revolved around religion. The bishop himself was on television right after one of the attacks and said, this is all about religion, and explained in great detail. So what's going on here, Marty, is actually that the judicial process now, this thing is still in play. The game's not over. It's a kind of intermission until we see how the government responds. It's really honing and polishing what will be the long-term judicial definition for what is a hate crime that relates not only to the Amish, not only to religion, but to people from those other groups who might be the victim of a hate crime because of their race or their sexual orientation or gender, a disability they have, or their country of origin. So it kind of upscales this case significantly in terms of what it means for all of us.
Well, it also raises a number of questions. One of them was, is this group, and I'm using the present tense, but is this group, was it Amish? I mean, if you list all the various ways that it didn't act like other Amish groups, for instance, didn't follow the sort of Christianity that's part of Amish.
Right. They rejected Christianity during some of the attacks. They said, well, we're not Christians. They stopped having religious services. They're paddling adults. The bishop's looking at their incoming mail. There's a high degree of control. And so I list actually 24 explicit ways in which, in my judgment, they're not Amish, even
right.
though they dress Amish. Now, it also has been described as the first Amish on Amish, meaning within a religious group. This is the first national case where the Shepherd Byrd law has been applied to religiously motivated hate crimes.
And that's Matthew Shepherd and James Byrd.
This is 2009 Shepherd Byrd,
right.
Which was the an extension of the federal hate crimes that prior to that had focused primarily on civil rights issues. So it's a major extension. But this is the first time that it's been applied for religious reasons. It's also been described as the first time within a religious group. The fact of the matter, that doesn't matter for Shepherd Byrd, because Shepherd Byrd says nothing about the person's religion who perpetrates a crime. All that Shepherd Byrd cares about is the victim. Was it done to the victim because of the victim's religion? So whether or not Burgholz was Amish or not, frankly, doesn't really matter.
But it does raise a question about whether these attacks were motivated by religion or whether it was something more personal than that.
Exactly. And that's what was at stake in the appellate court, because the one attack, the first one, involved 6 or 7 children and their adult spouses going to the home of their parents at night and attacking them. So in the trial, they said, well, these are just family feuds. These are squabbles between parents and children about proper parenting. I think the evidence is very clear that the underlying factor was religion, because the parents didn't like how the bishop was organizing his group and organizing the religious values and practices. And the children, even though they were adults, were in that context and hearing all of this, which I think was a major factor. But in any hate crime, there may be a multitude of factors at play. So how you determine what's the dominant one or the primary cause is kind of what's at stake in the appeal.
Well, it sounds like you believe it was a hate crime.
Well,
And you testified for the prosecution.
I testified for the prosecution, and I tried to explain Amish practices for them. I wasn't there as an expert on hate crimes, and I'm not a lawyer, and so I'm an expert on the Amish, and I was there in the trial trying to explain why they were doing certain things, what was typical Amish behavior, which group they were part of. There are 40 different Amish tribes and subgroups in North America, so I was basically taking that role. If I can give a hypothetical in terms of a hate crime, let's say I live here in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, and I'm involved in a property dispute with one of my neighbors. And my neighbor is a member of a Bamanite religion. This is a hypothetical religion. I'm making it up for the purpose of the
sure.
story. And I've never liked Bamanites. You know, I've always had an aversion to them. And my neighbor, right across the fence line, keeps throwing his leaves over, some of his trees hang over, and we've had this dispute going on. And also, his son made some nasty remarks at my daughter in elementary school, which I really dislike, you know, what his son's been doing to my daughter. And so I pick up a stone one night, and when my neighbor, this Bamanite, is out, I throw it and hit him and injure him. That's not a hate crime. It's not a hate crime because it doesn't involve interstate commerce. However, if I had gone to New Jersey, I've got an uncle there that runs a gun shop, and he was able to provide me with an assault rifle, and I bring it back into Pennsylvania and shoot my neighbor, disfigure him in some way, shoot off his arm, then that could potentially be a hate crime. But there are three criterias for it to be a federal hate crime. Has to be interstate commerce of some sort. Secondly, I have to cause bodily injury, which I do with the gun. And third, it has to be motivated because of his religion. I may think his religion is obnoxious and may despise it, but did I shoot him because of his religion? Now, there are three things at play here. You know, this argument about our property line, what his son did to my daughter, and the fact that I've always been upset about Bamanites and that particular religion. So it gets very complicated. Sure. For how does a jury untangle those three things? Is one of them, are they all significant factors? Are all three of them the main factor? Or is there just one main factor? And moreover, if I haven't written anything or actually spoken out about Bamanites, even though I really hate them, then how do you really know what my motive was? So it gets quite complicated.
Indeed it does. But how did this case involving the Burkholz Amish community, how did that involve interstate commerce?
Well, what the prosecution used were several things. There was a horse shears, a fairly long horse shears, very sharp shears for cutting a mane that the barbers used, Burkholz barbers, and that was manufactured out of state. There was a battery-operated clippers also used for animals that they used. That was manufactured out of state.
Wow.
The camera that they used to record what they were doing, a little disposable camera, was manufactured out of state. They used the U.S. Postal Service writing some letters, and they also traveled in some interstate highways. So there were four or five things that involved interstate commerce. Now, that's the case the prosecution made. And in fact, some legal scholars thought when the case was appealed to the appeals courts, to the appellate courts, that they might reverse it or raise questions because the evidence of interstate commerce was perhaps not strong enough. So that issue was not decided. The appellate court actually sidestepped that and addressed this error in the instructions to the jury instead. And there are a number of legal scholars that think the Commerce Clause in finding evidence is a thorny issue whenever you prosecute under Shepard Byrd.
And that's Donald Krehbiel, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And we're talking about something that happened several years ago, an attack by a number of Amish men on nine Amish men and women who had left their community. They cut off their beards and their hair. There was a trial, and the members that carried out these crimes found guilty. And then just last month in August, an appellate court overturned the hate crime verdicts, and our guest Donald Krehbiel has investigated this story. He testified at the trial, and he's written a book called Renegade Amish, Beard Cutting, Hate Crimes, and the Trial of the Burkholz Barbers. What was so interesting is that there were photos taken, and again, we don't think of people using cameras who have any
Amish
kind
people.
Of affiliation with an Amish community.
Well, this was one of the surprising ironies of the story as well. Apparently, on their way to the first attack, they stopped, and somebody at a corner drugstore or 7-Eleven picked up a disposable camera, took it along, and were taking photos at three or four of these attacks. They wanted to take them back to the community members that weren't there, back to the bishop, so they could see them. It turns out they never developed the film, and they were concerned that the FBI might look for it as evidence, and one of the young men in the community, like an 18 or 19-year-old, took it out when he was hunting in December of 2011, buried it under a big pile of leaves in the forest, but first of all put it inside two Ziploc bags. So it was perfectly preserved, and several months later the FBI discovered that, in fact, there was a camera. So they retrieved this, developed a film. They were afraid these are amateur photographers. Amish may be the first time they're using a camera. Secondly, Amish homes are very poorly lit at night. But the flash was working properly on the camera, and the photos turned out quite nice, actually. And so the prosecution used them as evidence at the trial. And some of them you see in the book.
In fact, when I saw them in the book, I thought, oh, this had to have been staged. I mean, this just, it's almost like too good to be true from a law enforcement angle. Was there reluctance, though, to get law enforcement involved in this case? The victims sort of going outside of their community and bringing in, for instance, the FBI?
Yes. Well, one view the Amish have is that they shouldn't use force in life. They base their way of life in the teachings of Jesus. You shouldn't retaliate. You should love your enemies. You shouldn't fight back to those who persecute you. And so if they are involved in a crime as a victim, they are generally reluctant to press charges. They may be willing to testify, but to actually press charges they view as a form of force. And I tell the story in the book about one of the bishops, a 76-year-old, who was the head of a sizable Amish affiliation, really was very reluctant to press charges. And he said, and I quote him in the book, he said, well, look what Jesus went through. You know, he was tortured. He died on the cross. He didn't press charges. He didn't retaliate. For goodness sakes, all I got was a haircut. I mean, why should I press charges? And so he struggled with this. Some of his children wanted him to press charges. A detective, and another interesting part of this story is the main detective for one of the attacks, for this bishop, in fact, was raised Amish and left the Amish, but he spoke Pennsylvania Dutch. So he was able to persuade this bishop that pressing charges is important here because it's a way to prevent other people from becoming harmed, because the Burkholz people seemed out of control. They actually had more attacks planned that were actually never carried out. And so the bishop eventually agreed to press charges, not to retaliate, but to prevent other people from getting injured or harmed. And the bishop then later came to the trial. He was actually the very last witness in the 3-week trial. He followed me where he testified to what he had seen and how he felt as one of the victims.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation again, talking with Donald Krehbiel about this pretty extraordinary case. It involved a cultish Amish group that was in Burkholz, Ohio, run by a very cultish leader named Samuel Mullet, a bishop. And he organized some members of this community to attack, cut the beards off of some of the Amish who had left the community or had been excommunicated. Donald Krehbiel's book is called Renegade Amish, and it's subtitled Beard Cutting, Hate Crimes, and the Trial of the Burkholz Barbers. He's an authority on the Amish, and he studies, or I should say, is a senior fellow at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and also open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Any questions or comments, join us after this short break.
Fringe Arts supports WHYY. Downtown New York dance meets the 1980s Harlem Vogue scene. High school football gets gender bent by an all-female and transgendered cast. An Iranian dissident under house arrest shares his life story in a script he smuggled out of his country. It's all part of the 2014 Fringe Festival, going on now through September 21st at Fringe Arts and all over Philly. More info at fringearts.com. That's fringearts.com.
The Australian comedy series Please Like Me is now on the U.S. cable network Pivot TV. On the next Fresh Air, Josh Thomas talks about creating and starring in the show, realizing he was gay in his 20s, and coming out to his dad through a text message.
So I texted him, I said, hey, what time is your flight getting tomorrow? Also, I have a boyfriend. See ya.
Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. When did we get so old? Every generation ages, but for boomers who thought they'd be forever young,
it seems to be harder to go from being the youngest person in a meeting to being the oldest. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, we'll talk about what lies behind our reluctance to age. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and if you're just joining us, Donald Craybill is our guest. He's a distinguished college professor, senior fellow at the Young Center for Anabaptist and Pietist Studies at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania. And we've been talking about his new book called Renegade Amish. As he writes in the introduction to the book, he's written a number of other books about the good Amish. And this is a book about the bad Amish, if we can say that. I think we can. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to get to our callers. We've got some emails as well. But I was also thinking back to 3 years ago when this happened, the kind of, I guess, jokes that people made about beard cutting and what this meant and sort of Amish behaving badly. And I'm just curious about how you took that. I mean, this is a community we don't know much about. Mm-hmm. It's a small community within the United States.
Well, two things. There was some humor. I point out in the book there was a cartoon of a Santa Claus sitting waiting for children to come. He had no beard, and he couldn't – the children were just passing him by.
Yes.
And so there was some humor related
yes.
to it.
Yes.
I think the other thing interesting, Marty, is that we have a kind of love-hate relationship with the Amish. In some ways, we really stole their family values, their strong sense of identity, their sense of community, their sense of continuity. And yet some of the things that are central to Amish life are things we actually abhor. I mean, they emphasize community, and we want individualism. We're into consumerism, where they tend to be much more restrained in terms of that. And so we have this love-hate relationship. And I think sometimes when we hear about Amish failures, some of us tend to feel, well, sure, they're just human like we are, and they aren't goody-goodies after all. They aren't as righteous as it may appear like they are. So I think there was some of that kind of reaction to hear this. And then with the Amish Mafia show, people say, oh, well, the Amish
Channel.
Mafia
right.
show must really be a real reality show. I mean, I've argued many times, I mean, there's nothing like an Amish Mafia, and there isn't. And yet this would be an example of Amish using violence. And so it's really abhorrent, and it's absolutely contradictory to the basic values of Amish life of pacifism, nonviolence, forgiveness, and non-retaliation.
And would it be fair to say, or were members of other Amish communities, were they, in a sense, traumatized by this? Or?
Well, people within 90 miles in all directions of Bergholtz were afraid. Amish bishops, I know at least three of them, who were using pepper spray. They were carrying pepper spray. They were afraid of being attacked. People were putting locks on their doors for the first time. Even in the last 2 weeks, I've had three calls from Amish people worried that because of the reversal of the hate crime verdicts, Mollett and some of his henchmen are going to get out of prison soon, and they're still afraid. So they were very fearful. Beyond that, it was disgraceful to the Amish of Pennsylvania, to the Amish in every other state. It was like shameful, disgraceful, and people began mixing up their Amish identity with this Bergholtz group. So it was a very shameful thing for Amish people everywhere, very embarrassing.
We have an email from Brian. Can you touch upon the unique challenges of prosecutors faced in bringing victims on board when trying the perpetrators? I mean, and as you describe, I think there were something like 20 lawyers. I mean, obviously there are a number of cases here.
It was a complicated trial. I mean, in the courtroom when I was there, there are 16 defendants. Each of them has a lawyer that's sitting beside them. And then there are four other lawyers working with the prosecution. And there were five different cases, events of beard cutting, 16 defendants, and 9 victims. But the listener raises a really interesting and important question that Amish people are very reluctant to testify. this was a Klan, and four or five of the people that testified were brothers or sisters of Bishop Mollett, were his own children. They were subpoenaed. They had to testify. So it was very difficult, very traumatic emotionally for these people to need to testify, which also is a reason for some of the fear, because people that testified against him, they worry what could happen to them, perhaps, if some of the defendants are released. So it was very challenging for the prosecution. I mean, the caller is exactly right. And with the issue of not wanting to press charges and to be sensitive to these people, be sensitive to their trauma, some of the prosecutors were excellent. I mean, they did a phenomenal job. And I really respect the way they were sensitive to the human dimensions here of this case.
And what was the defense? I mean, how did they defend themselves?
Well, the basic defense was this had nothing to do with religion. This was about family squabbles. And, I mean, they were doing that to reject verdicts of guilt under the Shepherd Byrd hate crime, because you can't be charged with a federal hate crime just because you attacked your mother or attacked your child or whatever. And so basically their line was this was about family differences. This was about family animosities and so on. That was the basic line of defense. No one objected. What's interesting, Marty, there's no dispute about the fact that the attacks took place, no dispute about who the victims were, no dispute about who did it. The dispute is the motive and also the instrumentality of the Interstate Commerce Clause. I mean, that's where was that evidence weighty enough to merit federal hate crime prosecution?
Using things like shears, I mean, literally what they used to cut off the beards. Now, Sam Mollett got 15, or Bishop Sam Mollett 15. Got 15 years.
He's in a penitentiary, a federal penitentiary in Texas. And there were seven men that got five to 7 years, so about eight of them. The other eight, all but one, are out already. They had just one-year crimes. A lot of them were kind of tag-alongs. Six of them were women, and they are out, with the exception of one woman had 2 years. So about eight of them are back in Bergholtz. But the culprits, and the other issue here with talking about the culprits,
yes,
it's not only the bishop, but the two ministers of the settlement. So the entire ordained group of clergy, the entire group are in federal penitentiaries. Just bizarre, unheard of in Amish history.
So does this community, does it still exist?
Oh, yes.
I mean, without Sam Mollett, these religious leaders?
Well, he's in communication by telephone or correspondence, and the bulk of the families there are his children, adult children, or other closely related ones. There are about 20 households there. I don't know what their future will be. I think the future is uncertain. It's a complicated thing for the children that grow up there. I mean, they have sizable families. So it's very difficult to predict the future at this point for the community.
Have they been shunned, or are they being shunned by other Amish communities?
You know, a number of people said to me if Mollett or these people would apologize for what they have done, if they would simply apologize, we would take them up quickly. So, I mean, they were in 2006, 300 ministers decided not to respect and not to – they basically nullified his ability to excommunicate. That's about all they could do, and that's what was behind a lot of the factors that led up to the attacks.
Let me get – it looks like Gavin, who's been waiting patiently from Newark, Delaware. Gavin, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
I get the impression that a lot of the Amish communities that have spread out from Pennsylvania – tend to be stricter and more insular than some of the Amish here in eastern PA. And I wonder if that's true, and if so, why, and if that might have had any impact on this case.
That's an interesting question, Gavin. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would say, Gavin, yes, you're exactly correct. You've done your homework. But I would say I don't think it has an impact on this case. A lot of Amish families that leave southeastern Pennsylvania moved to more rural areas in Kentucky, in central and upper New York State, into Wisconsin and Missouri, and even areas of Indiana. They are going there to buy cheaper farmland. They also tend to be more conservative, more strict, and they want to be away from tourism. They want to be away from the suburbanization, from all the temptations in the Philadelphia area that might seduce young Amish teenagers. And they want rural solitude, basically, to raise their children without the same amount of temptations that you might find in a more urban area. So you're exactly right. I don't think that had an impact in this case, but it's correct that the new settlements tend to be small and they tend to be in more isolated areas.
And more conservative. I mean, if you
correct.
Want to get away from all the sins
correct.
Of Philadelphia, then
correct.
You probably are. Gavin, thanks for the call. Let me see what Elam from Lancaster has to say. Elam, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, my question is, by making this a hate crime, doesn't that come into the area of the government taking sides in a religious dispute? And how will that play out if one aspect of a religion is protected over another, or just simply intervening?
Sure, no, I think this is why this case is so interesting and maybe even controversial, because it does include religion as part of hate crime.
Well, the same, it would apply to state hate crimes. Like Pennsylvania has an enhancement factor for state hate crimes that would involve religion. I think the only time that it is the only time that the crime, that an act, an interreligious act is criminalized is if it involves bodily injury. This is according to the federal statute. So you can yell at each other, you can scream at each other, you can write nasty letters to each other about another person's religion. That's not criminalized, and that's protected by the First Amendment. But the moment you attack somebody, then it becomes criminalized if you actually and I guess that the First Amendment does not protect anyone for saying that their religion motivated them to hurt somebody or injure them. It only protects free speech and free practice as long as the practice is not violent.
Well, I think Elam was also getting to the fact that if this is a religious dispute, then the government does pick a side, obviously.
If it involves physical violence that causes bodily injury. I mean, yeah.
Let me see what looks like Roberta from East Windsor, New Jersey, has to say. Hi, Roberta. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi,
yes, I called. I grew up among the Amish Mennonite. My mother was raised Amish Mennonite, and I attended Amish Sunday schools. I lived in the Elverson-Morgantown area, and I heard the professor say something that I believe he was referring to the actual bishop, saying that he was not Amish. And I feel that the acts that this man committed were more of a perverted nature, not related to religions at all, and that he is just merely a criminal.
Well, Roberta, I appreciate the call. Let me give our guest a chance to respond. Go ahead.
Well, I didn't say he wasn't. He says he is Amish. Throughout the trial, he says he is Amish. What I am saying is that his group, I don't think, fits the definition of the typical Orthodox conventional Amish.
He is a criminal, though, right?
Well, he was convicted of these crimes. And by the way, apart from the hate crimes, he is still convicted of lying to the FBI, being part of a conspiracy, and concealing evidence. So he's certainly a criminal in that aspect. And the caller gets to a good question. There may be psychological factors here. There may be other issues going on. I'm not really qualified to speak to them. Which they may have nothing to do about his religion. Nevertheless, he is the leader of what was formerly a religious Amish community.
But you do include in this book 25 irregular practices in the Bergholtz community. I mean, at what point, and some of these are pretty egregious, accepting sexual misconduct, excommunicating members without just cause or process, rejecting a Christian identity. Within, though, the Amish community and belief system, at what point do you not become Amish, even if you say you are? I mean, is there a point in which other Amish.
Well, I would say the litmus test is if you stop having religious services. I mean,
which they did, right?
Right. Plus the other 24 things. But again, there's no patent on the name Amish. Anybody can do anything they want to, regardless how bizarre it is, and say they're Amish. I mean, there's no legal protection for using that name or trademark.
We're almost out of time here, but do you think then other members of the Amish community might rethink that, thinking people could appropriate our religion, do all these horrible things, and still call themselves
Amish? I think
this
was a big lesson for Amish across North America to say we need to be careful that this kind of thing doesn't develop again. It's not only an Amish lesson, but it's a lesson for other religious communities where an independent congregation or a bishop or a minister with excessive authority could abuse that authority.
And I guess you'll be waiting, as will a lot of other people, for whatever court has to make a decision on this appellate court.
Well, the prosecutors are deciding what to do. I mean, they have several options. They could appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. They could go back to the appellate court and ask for all the judges or some 20 judges to vote on it. They could have a retrial, or they could drop the hate crime charges and resentence some of the members because of concealing evidence, being part of a conspiracy, or lying to the FBI.
Well, much more to think about and talk about. Donald Krehbiel, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And his book is called Renegade Amish, Beard Cutting, Hate Crimes, and the Trial of the Burkholz Barbers. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, and how to download podcasts of the program. Quinn Lipson, our intern this fall. Adam Staniszewski, our engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.